they're just going off of paperwork and their own feelings about what they see number-wise.
Hugh Neff says he'll appeal his ban from next year's Yukon Quest. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Nome prison is the site of the first romaine lettuce E. coli case in the state.
What we're talking about here is a type of E. coli, a Shiga toxin producing E. coli, and so it can be pretty damaging.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Curious about your alcohol habits or those of someone you care about? Find a free and confidential alcohol screening at recoveralaska.org or call 211 today. This Alcohol Awareness Month, Recover Alaska reminds us that together we are stronger than alcohol addiction. Recover Alaska is a trusted source for alcohol research and resources, including an index of local available treatment options. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
The Alaska Supreme Court heard arguments today in a case that will decide the fate of one of this year's most closely watched ballot initiatives. The Yes for Salmon initiative aims to toughen the permitting process for projects in salmon habitat. But the state of Alaska argues it goes against the state constitution. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk was at the Alaska Supreme Court to hear lawyers from both sides argue their case. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
So why is this case so important?
First off, this case is kind of a vehicle for a fight between industry groups and Alaska Native corporations and other folks who support resource development and folks who believe salmon habitat deserves more protection when people want to put in projects in the state. And this has kind of been a long-running battle in Alaska over projects like Pebble and the Susitna Dam. This is another manifestation of that fight. This case is really important because this will decide the fate of this ballot initiative, whether it ends up on the ballot, whether it doesn't, or if it ends up on the ballot changed in some form.
How did this ballot initiative end up at the Alaska Supreme Court?
So the sponsor of the initiative initially tried to send it into the State Division of Elections, and the State Division of Elections last summer was like, you know, this does not pass the constitutional test. You need to change it. So they did that. They made some changes and sent it to the state, and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott rejected it. Then they appealed. It ended up at the Superior Court. Superior Court ruled in their favor. The state appealed that, and that's how we ended up at the Supreme Court today.
So what did you hear? What are some of the main arguments in the case?
First, I should say what they weren't arguing over. They weren't saying that this was whether this is good policy or not. This wasn't an argument over whether the Pebble Mine is a good idea or not. This wasn't an argument over whether this is overly burdensome for the industry. This wasn't just strictly over whether this is constitutional under the state constitution. And the specific provision they were arguing over is whether this is an unconstitutional provision of state assets, whether this would prevent the legislature from allowing a project in certain areas wholesale. And the supporters of the ballot initiative say this gives the legislature some wiggle room. They can decide to allow a big mine. It just increases the protections that the state has. The state disagrees. The state thinks that this would completely prevent certain projects, and so it doesn't follow the state constitution.
How about the justices? What was the reaction from the Alaska Supreme Court justices today? And did you pick up any cues on how they're leaning?
I can't say whether they are, you know, what they're going to say, but one thing they really focused on and asked a lot of questions about was whether they can take out certain parts of this ballot initiative and still send it in, like, and make it be okay under the state constitution and still send it to the ballot, whether that would preserve kind of the heart and soul of this ballot initiative if they were to do that, or if by doing that they would really be changing what all the signatories in this ballot initiative wanted when they signed on to this initiative. So they asked a lot of questions about that. When I talked to the initiative supporters, you know, they want the initiative to kind of go on the ballot as it's written now, but they indicated that it would be okay with them if the Supreme Court took out kind of the most prescriptive lines in this initiative and left the rest of it as is.
Sounds like a really interesting back and forth. Set the scene for us. What was it like at the courthouse or the courtroom today?
It was pretty packed. It was kind of a who's who in the state industry groups. You had folks from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association there, and the folks from the Resource Development Council were there, among others. You also had supporters of the initiative, of course, and the lawyer arguing the case is with Trustees for Alaska. And you also had the sponsor, Mike Wood, who is a longtime Susitna Dam opponent, and the Wild Salmon Center, which is an environmental group based in Portland, but with folks here in Alaska. There are representatives from them as well. So kind of if you wanted to know who really has a dog in this fight, you kind of like look around this courtroom and they were all there.
Elizabeth, did you get clarity on when the decision might come out?
So during the case today, the state requested that a decision happen by early September. That way, if the Supreme Court does allow it to go forward, that gives them time to print out the ballots. But I was talking to a lawyer with the state yesterday, and they thought it's possible for the Supreme Court to put out a decision on this a little earlier than that. So maybe within the next month, no guarantees on that, but we could be seeing a ruling on this pretty soon, potentially.
All right. Thanks so much for following the case and coming in to tell us about it today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk reporting on the case in front of the Alaska Supreme Court to hear about the ballot initiative on the Yes for Salmon proposal. The Senate Finance Committee has proposed a capital budget that would be nearly $1.5 billion for the coming year. The capital budget would fund scores of projects across the state. The Senate proposal is $270 million less than that proposed by Governor Bill Walker. But Walker proposed a tax on wages to pay for some of the costs, and the Senate plan doesn't include the tax. The committee heard public testimony on the proposal today. Tourism industry representatives asked the committee to restore $3 million in tourism marketing that Walker had proposed and the Senate cut. Robert Terrazas of Anchorage owns a small tour business. He says the marketing money is important.
The $3 million that the state invests in having people come to us is well spent.
Other members of the public ask for more funding for Medicaid and for community public safety patrols. Roughly one-tenth of the capital budget is state spending. The rest comes from the federal government. A legislative ethics committee has found probable cause that Representative Garantar violated ethics law by having staff help organize and fundraise for a 2017 street fair. No sanctions were recommended against the Anchorage Democrat, but the committee in a release said it strongly recommends that Tar seek guidance from the ethics office before committing government resources to a project that would benefit a private benefit. The complaint alleged that Tar and staff members worked on the Mountain View Street Fair Festival on government time using government resources for a non-legislative purpose. The committee says one part-time aide alone spent more than 120 hours of government or staff time helping with the event. Tar says she disagrees with some of the findings, but is pleased with the recommendation of no sanctions. The United Nations organization that regulates international shipping recently decided to move toward banning the use of heavy fuel oil in the Arctic. The thick oil could present unique challenges for cleanup in the event of a spill, especially in cold temperatures. Environmental groups are cheering the decision, but the ban is still a ways from becoming a reality. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has this report.
Heavy fuel oil, also called HFO, is relatively cheap, which is why it's commonly used by big commercial ships around the world, and to a lesser but still significant degree, in the Arctic. Kevin Herron is the Arctic Program Director for Pacific Environment, an international conservation organization. He represented the group in early April in London at the meeting of one of the committees of the International Maritime Organization.
It is a big deal that the IMO has been looking at a ban. It's a very cautious body, and it normally does not act without strong support from countries.
The United States was one of several countries that submitted a paper recommending the move. Heavy fuel oil is, well, heavy, and it could present some particular difficulties in a spill. It sinks in many cases when it's cold, and it doesn't disperse easily. Austin Amasuk from Nome also attended the meeting. He's a marine advocate for the Bering Strait Regional Nonprofit Corporation, Kowarik, and he supports HFO being taken out of use in the Arctic.
We want our waters as pristine as possible, and a heavy fuel oil spill or burning of heavy fuel oil represents or is some of the dirtiest ship power generation that exists.
One of Amasuk's big concerns is how such a spill could affect marine subsistence resources in the Bering Strait region. Even though the regulatory group made the decision to start developing a ban, there's still a lot that will have to happen before it's put in place. Jeff Lance with the U.S. Coast Guard was the lead representative for the U.S. at the meeting. He says the group will have to assess the impacts of a ban.
It would be looking at the environmental benefit, but it would also be looking at the cost to shipping. It could be looking at the cost to communities in the Arctic. Would it raise the cost for delivery of goods and services to these communities?
Once the assessment is done, the terms of the ban will have to be negotiated, including things like when it would go into effect. A final decision may still be several years out. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state's largest tribal government builds up its business development.
We need to be able to manage ourselves sustainably, not so dependent on the federal government.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
Musher Hugh Neff is talking back to Yukon Quest organizers who this week banned him from next year's race for poor dog care. The censure announced on Tuesday is based on a necropsy of a Neff dog named Bobby who died in this year's race. The post-mortem analysis found the dog to be in generally poor health prior to aspirating on vomit. In a video posted on his Facebook page, Neff, a two-time past Quest champion from Tok, confirms he will appeal the disciplinary action, characterizes it as a personal attack, and says he won't grovel.
I'm not going to go in front of a board of people that I know don't like me and won't respect my word to get them to try to change their minds, which this is the opportunity they've been waiting for.
The Quest has boards in Alaska and the Yukon, which approved the censure based on recommendations of a separate race rules committee. Committee chair, veterinarian Kathleen McGill, was unavailable for comment today. The necropsy on Boppy found that the dog had stomach ulcers, intestinal inflammation, worms, skeletal muscle necrosis, severe weight loss, and muscle wasting. A Quest musher who has never before been censured for poor dog care. Neff says he's been singled out when other mushers have also had, quote, dog issues.
Obviously, dogs get skinny when it's 50 below out and you're running 1,000 miles and you're trying to pour food into them. They never even interviewed the people at 40 Mile where this incident happened. And that just blows my mind. So they're just going off of paperwork and their own feelings about what they see number-wise.
Under the Quest censure, Neff is banned from the 2019 Quest and must complete the shorter Quest 300 before being able to register for the 1,000-mile race in the future. Neff says he loves the Quest and will not back down. Meanwhile, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals is calling for Alaska and Yukon authorities to investigate Neff for what they call alleged cruelty to animals. Alaska has reported its first cases of a strain of E. coli bacteria related to a national outbreak going on this month. All 8 confirmed cases in Alaska are inmates currently residing in Nome's Anvil Mountain Correctional Center. According to a press release from the state, the investigation of the outbreak is ongoing, but as of Wednesday, no additional E. coli cases have been reported by AMCC or elsewhere in the state. Louise Casterdale is an epidemiologist with the state's Department of Health and Social Services. She confirms that all 8 inmates contracted a specific strain of the bacteria through eating romaine lettuce served at AMCC.
What we're talking about here is a type of E. coli, a Shiga toxin-producing E. coli, and so it can be pretty damaging to people, and it can cause some severe illness, vomiting and diarrhea, and they can have bloody diarrhea. And so this is generally when we think about E. coli 0157 infections, it's a gastrointestinal infection.
State and national entities are investigating more than 50 E. coli cases across 16 states. Casterdale says by collaborating with those entities, they have determined that the infectious lettuce came from Yuma, Arizona, but don't know which specific farm.
We also work very closely because there is a food product suspected here to be the cause with our partners in food safety. So the Department of Environmental Conservation, they're working with FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and CDC to help figure out, well, where did this lettuce come from? You know, what farm? Can they trace it back? How far can they trace it back? And to sort of, you know, look at all the distribution loops to see why certain states are seeing it and certain venues.
In order to control the outbreak within AMCC, Megan Edge, a spokesperson with the Department of Corrections, says their staff and medical support implemented rigorous hygiene requirements earlier this month, like more frequent hand scrubbing.
Outbreaks like this in a prison setting can be a little stressful because everybody lives so close together. Everybody interacts so closely all the time. So we really do have really good medical staff, and there's really good staff at Anvil because they really had to go into overdrive to make sure that this incident was contained. That meant that, I mean, just a really good scrubbing of everything in the facility.
Edge says lettuce was taken off the menu temporarily, but AMCC will again start serving it from another grower.
And we just aren't going to use the product that we have from Arizona. We're going to follow the CDC's recommendations ourselves and just not risk it. We're still working at logistics of where we'll continue to get product from, but there are other options outside of Arizona. And, you know, we do have a correctional farm out in Mat-Su that we're getting ready to head into growing season. And that's always a huge relief for us because we can take a lot of product that we are growing ourselves and use at the facilities.
According to Edge, none of the 8 patients with confirmed E. coli cases were hospitalized, and all of them are back within the general population of 117. An Alaska Native corporation will soon provide support services for the U.S. Navy in Guantanamo Bay on the island of Cuba. Tlingit Haida Tribal Business Corporation won the nearly $20 million contract earlier this month. As Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports, it's another step in the growth of the profit-making arm of the state's largest tribal government.
Tlingit Haida Tribal Business Corporation is owned by the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. The council lists more than 30,000 tribal members in Southeast, the rest of Alaska, and around the world. Business Corporation subsidiary Kira announced the Guantanamo contract April 12th. It will manage maintenance services, port operations, and waterfront administration for the base. The corporation announced a similar $44 million contract about a week earlier for the Marine Corps Air Base in South Carolina. The contracts are among more than a dozen providing military and other government support services from Florida to Alaska. Corporation CEO Richard Reinhardt says it continues to seek more work.
I look at it as it's like long lining. We have all these lines out with lots of hooks, and we're out there fishing, and by having more lines in the water, we're hopeful to bring more home.
Reinhardt and others discussed the business corporation's progress at the Central Council's recent tribal assembly in Juneau. He says sales were about $60 million last year, close to twice the amount of the previous year. Reinhardt projects about 30% more sales for the current year. Net income last year was under $1 million, but it was a third more than the previous year. Reinhardt says the amount will increase as startup costs are paid off. General Manager Bob Hamilton says military and other contracts are due, in part, to the corporation's 8A status. That's a provision in federal law that gives minority-owned and disadvantaged businesses a bidding preference. He says the corporation began with janitorial contracts.
And now we're in IT, security, aircraft logistics as far as supports and service for aircraft, and we're actually in port management. So we've really come a long ways.
Tlingit and Haida Tribal Business Corporation officials say it employs about 600 people. Most of the jobs are in other parts of the country, but the corporation's hiring policy includes a preference for tribal members. Tlingit Haida Central Council President Richard Peterson made business development part of his platform when he ran for office 4 years ago. He told this year's Tribal Assembly it's still a top priority.
We're only as sovereign as we can afford to be. We need economic sovereignty. We need to be able to manage ourselves sustainably, not so dependent on the federal government, so that we can exercise true self-determination and do what we see fit for our tribal citizens.
Peterson was re-elected president at the Tribal Assembly. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Alaska Native Village Corporation Association's 10th Annual Conference and Board Meeting is May 10th and 11th in Anchorage at the Egan Center. Learn about new developments and opportunities from Alaska's business leaders, network with Alaska Native Corporation executives, and hear from the nation's top figures in Native contracting and small business. Agenda and registration at anvca.biz. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association.
The Native Youth Olympics kicked off today in Anchorage. More than 400 high school athletes from across Alaska are in town for the statewide championship, which tests strength, endurance, and agility.
Probably the most popular games that people know really well, here in Alaska at least, are the high kicking games, where there's a suspended ball in the air.
Kyle Dementif Whirl teaches an NYO team from Juneau. He spoke to the Associated Press about the different games his athletes will compete in.
There's a seal hop, which looks like you're in a push-up position and you hop with your hands curled in like this in a lower push-up position. You go for distance. It's a game of endurance.
It's also a game meant to mimic how subsistence hunters snuck up on seals on the sea ice. Another event called the Scissor Broad Jump replicates leaping from one ice floe to the next in the Arctic Ocean. The Native Youth Olympics run today through Saturday. Opening ceremonies started this afternoon at the Alaska Airlines Center in Anchorage. Winter is winding down in Alaska, with most trails in Anchorage already clear of snow. But you can still find freezing temperatures if you hike up high into the mountains. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell explored the still snowy Chugach Range with NPR reporter Brian Mann and sent us this postcard.
It's still dark outside, the stars are out, and just off in the distance behind the dark silhouetted mountains, you can see some orange and yellow colors starting to rise.
We're heading up a trail that leads high into the mountains here in the Chugach Range.
If we were doing this hike in the summertime, we wouldn't really be able to see much because there are these big willow bushes, but we've just got this really clear open view that's pretty rewarding from the start.
There's a sudden flurry up ahead, an explosion of white and black feathers.
You had said you'd been seeing little tracks in the snow.
I kind of guessed maybe they were ptarmigan.
Yeah.
At first they were just kind of like these beautiful little white bodies running through the snow. Very pretty.
Yeah. It's tough climbing so far. I mean, the trail is not too technical, which is nice, but it's steep. I'm in some pain right now.
But it's also kind of impossibly beautiful. We're in this narrow valley right now, and down here where we are, it's still dark and cold.
Finally, the sun creeps down the ridge. We find a sunny spot out of the wind for a little break.
So we're eating lunch. We're having pizza and caribou sticks. We're perched on a ridge right in the middle of the valley here.
We're looking down to Ptarmigan Arm, and the mountains just rise straight up from the water. So it's just, I don't know, it's unlike any other place I've ever been.
We feel like explorers. We follow different paths on different days into different parts of the Chugach.
Sometimes we're in snowfields. sometimes we scramble over high bare rock.
So we're climbing in this enormous scree field below the ridge. Is this fun? I think a lot of people hear this and they're like, you know, why are you doing that?
Okay, so that's fair. To be honest, it's a question I ask myself a lot when I'm in a place like this. We just spent the better part of an hour slogging up through sharp pebbles. But then, out of nowhere, the world just drops away.
Where we are now, we can see all of Anchorage stretched out in the sun, in this big snow-filled valley.
The last hurdle before the summit is an outcropping of boulders balanced on the ridge.
So I find being up like in this kind of a place kind of scary.
It's very scary.
It doesn't feel safe, so we turn back. We start the long scramble down. That's when we see them.
A herd of doll sheep, horns curved like conch shells. They're perched on an outcrop nearby.
The hike home has one last surprise.
I spotted something in the bushes. I want to show you what it is.
Okay.
You see that?
Not yet.
Let's walk a little closer.
Okay. It is a moose.
Yeah.
And he's just hunkered down.
Yeah.
We are nearly down, and that was super hard.
It was extremely hard.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you know, one of the things that's true about Alaska is that it is Alaska.
Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, when you come to the end of a day like this, do you think never again?
It's one of those things where you're miserable. But now that we're off the scramble, no, of course.
Let's go.
Let's go. Let's do it again.
Reporting in the Chugach Range, I'm Brian Mann.
And I'm Emily Russell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Ravenna Koenig and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Teresa Katsarillis in Bethel, and Davis Hovey in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the Federal Plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.